Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt with Rolling Stone, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. With me today is Rolling Stone Executive Editor Nathan Brackett.
What's up, Brian? Here we are, live.
Here we are, live. And we'll have some special guests I'll mention in one moment. In the first part of this episode, we'll be talking about an anti-Trump musical project called 30 Days, 30 Songs. And later, we'll be honoring Chuck Berry on his 90th birthday. But to discuss 30 Days, 30 Songs, we have with us today an amazing panel of guests. First of all, Dave Eggers, author, McSweeney's founder, Gen X icon, and the co-organizer of this project. We have one of the great rock vocalists of our time, Corn Tucker of Slater Kinney, of course, and now of a very cool supergroup called Filthy Friends, with former R.E.M. guitarist Peter Buck. Hey, Corn.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So 30 Days, 30 Songs, how would you describe it to the person who has not heard of it?
Well, I think it's a really cool artistic project, right? So it's basically taking the idea of what a Trump presidency would do to this country and what it would mean, and putting that thought kind of into the minds of songwriters. And every single day is a different song related to that idea in the hands of a different songwriter.
So it's a project about how awesome a Trump presidency will be.
Just catastrophic, I think, it would be for our country.
We knew it was one or the other.
Yeah, just checking. And, I mean, what was it like to write a song to order like this on a topic at a time?
Well, here's the crazy thing about our song, is that I actually had written it 2 years before.
Ah.
And I had been thinking about the next presidential election and thinking about how much I feel like our country is changing and that we are having this huge generational shift in between the kind of ideology of like my parents' generation, right? And the generation that's come up since mine, which is Gen X, is, you know, the millennial generation and the kind of younger people that are going to lead this country forward. And just thinking about how big of a shift I feel like our country is going to go through. But for some reason, I had in my mind this kind of figurehead running for president, right? This is before Trump had even announced his candidacy.
Weird.
But I know, it is weird. It's a weird thing about being a songwriter sometimes, is that you get these like flashes of inspiration. But I had this gut feeling of wanting to tell this person off. And to do so in this way of like talking about this power exchange, that I had this feeling was going to be kind of ugly, right?
That's kind of crazy, because when I would have 100% thought that you wrote this to order.
I know.
Holding
well,
on.
When he announced his candidacy, I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Right? But then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
I'm reminded here of how when one of the producers of Idiocracy, the Mike Judge movie, just came on Twitter saying that he didn't know it was going to be a documentary. But
yeah, exactly.
So did you record it 2 years ago, or did you just record it now with Filthy Friends?
We recorded it like the end of 2013.
Huh. And,
yeah.
And just to step back for a second, how did Filthy Friends come together? It's a project with Peter Buck. What is the kind of, and you guys are recording an album, correct?
Yeah. So Peter Buck made a solo album, I want to say like maybe he was working on it in 2012. And just asked me to sing on it. And we just, you know, it just was a really cool collaboration. It was just like two musicians with kind of different skill sets, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, mine is really, my strong suit is really being a vocalist. And we just worked really well together. And he was like, hey, you know, we should kind of see if we can write some more songs together.
Yeah, and I'm dying to hear that album. I do want to introduce our other guests who are with us now. I won't say all that stuff about Dave Eggers again, but the guy I mentioned earlier, the great author. Dave, welcome.
Oh, hey. Thank you. Welcome to you, too.
Welcome to myself. And Matt Berninger, it's the hard G.
Can you hear me?
It's a hard, yes, I can. It's a hard G.
Oh, right, good. It is, I don't remember. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's Matt Berninger.
Okay, Berninger. Okay.
It's soft around the middle. Go ahead.
of the National and currently your other band, Elvi. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Thank you.
Matt's calling in from our LA office.
Yeah, I've been here listening the whole time, Corinne. You sounded the great, great chat so far. You were very, that was great. Continue. I don't want to interrupt.
All right, drop the mic.
I do have to point out that we have, two of my favorite vocalists in rock, and one is at the very lowest end of the spectrum, and the other one is at the highest. I do find that excellent to bring
who's
it together.
Who? Yeah. Which is which?
So. I'll go back to Dave. So Dave, I understand that this project started when you went to a Trump rally, which must have been quite an experience covering it for the Guardian. What happened there?
I felt like I had to see this in person, the phenomenon and what was going on at these rallies, and so I went to one in Sacramento, which was surprisingly calm and civilized and full of actually very kind people and a lot of elderly people, and it was very surreally convivial and affable. Everybody was kind of nice to each other, and I don't know, it was very surprising.
Huh.
But then this airplane pulls up, and the soundtrack to Trump's airplane full of hate and ignorance was Elton John's Tiny Dancer, the speakers, and he played that song twice that night, and he also played a lot of Springsteen and Queen, and I just thought, and every day you'd see these musicians, so upset about their music being played at these rallies, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to create a compilation of music that was pre-approved for the next Trump rally, and that was the original title for the project, songs pre-approved for the next Trump rally. But
has he used any yet?
A few times away from that.
Yeah, I guess he hasn't played any of them yet. I was hoping maybe.
Not yet.
We have a few days left. Yeah.
Given
I'm
his
hoping that just mistakenly one slips in there and. Then I just started talking to people. I was working with Jim James on something else, and we just started talking about it and sort of lamenting that there aren't enough protest songs or hadn't been enough this year. And and then, talked to Jordan Curlin, who manages Death Cab for Cutie, and it just started snowballing, and then the song started pouring in maybe a month and a half ago. And at this point, there's so many that it looks like we'll have 60 songs
nice.
In 3 days instead of 30.
Can we just prolong the election for a little?
Oh, please, yes.
Yeah,
that's what we all want. And Matt, did you write your song custom for this project?
Yeah. Brent and I wrote it really quick, and it's not a think piece necessarily. Ours is more of just like a cathartic experience. This, it's a nonsense song, and we made a video game that you can actually play on the website too. And it was fast and loose and recklessly put together. I didn't want to. Everything was so serious. I kind of just felt like making this, and a lot of these songs on this whole list are just using sarcasm and humor to address it, the confusion and frustration and anger that everybody feels. I don't mention Trump, and I don't even. I use some sound bites from him, and we do some things that obviously are obvious references to this whole election and the ugliness of it. But we wanted this song to just feel cathartic, and because I feel like now is the time we need to start laughing with each other again, and I feel like it's like time for like the family, meaning America, just had a terrible Thanksgiving where everybody hates each other, and we need to get back together and sit down and just watch a TV show together or something and get our family back together and laugh. It's like we need to heal. I know we have 20 more days of pain, but it's time we have to start healing as a country, I think.
Maybe we can hear Elvi's song, which is "Are These My Jets?" which makes it completely clear just from the title that it
is the title actually a Trump quote.
No. I think it was the same thing that Corinne was saying about it. It's like the idea of like maybe just getting inside the head of someone.
Right.
Maybe he was in over their head, and there's also a bunch of dick references, so be careful.
Last night I had an amazing. can feel up at the top of my moving staircase. This is the place where I dream my dreams. This is the place where I dream my dreams.
That, I think it shows the power of absurdism and and confusion, and just a really beautiful song to maybe make us think about all this. A corn song we don't seem to have. I don't think you've actually released it yet. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
So but I have heard it, and it has a sort of Patti Smith vibe, which I guess the combination of you and Peter might somehow produce.
We have a crew on BitTorrent actually trying to find it right now.
Dave, I would ask you, because you've been involved with each and every one of these songs. I mean, what has struck you, what has surprised you about these songs that all these great songwriters, including the ones with us today, are writing against Trump?
Well, I think it's sort of what Matt was saying was, you know, everybody's coming at it from very different angles, and I think so many of the songs are so beautifully oblique and not necessarily, you know, very few of them actually reference Trump directly, or actually at least use his name. And I think that everybody came at it in a really in a different way. You know, I think Ben's song, the very first one, the Death Cab song,
Million Dollar Loan
was just like a really interesting entry point, and the video was so beautiful. And I think, you know, what I'm shocked by, but not, I guess, pleasantly, I don't know if I'm surprised, but the artfulness of so many of these songs that were created in a very short amount of time is kind of astounding. Corn's song is beautifully written, and Elvi's song is perfectly absurd and appropriately.
I thought you were going to say beautifully written.
Beautifully written. And I thought I said that was implicit. This thing was really just a notion, and then suddenly a few songs came in, and Bibi Man's song came in, and it was one of the first ones, and I thought, wow, this actually might turn into something. And now, I don't know, I think that we're at a point where everyone feels helpless, or has felt helpless, as this sort of steamroller of bigotry and horror has kind of overtaken the country for the last 16 months. And even though these are songs and not, you know, they don't necessarily change an election or pivot it on a dime, although I will say that when Trump's numbers started dropping dramatically, that was right after that Cap song went up. So maybe there's a direct correlation.
Listeners can make the connection themselves. Yeah.
Correlation always means causation. That's one thing we've learned.
I think, you know, but I think we all feel like we need to do something. And that's what's been so encouraging about this sort of outpouring of all this really great music in a short amount of time. I think people feel like they need to react, need to say something in a wide variety of voices.
Cool. And we're going to take a break for 1 second, and we'll be right back.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
That bastard making fun of me in front of all my peers. Those people think I own this town, you're stripping all my gears.
So, guys, I was going to ask you, I was going to read you a quote from Kurt Vonnegut about the Vietnam War. Basically said that every serious writer, painter, stand-up comedian, musician, actor, actress, you name it, came out against this thing. We formed what might be described as a laser beam of protest, with everyone aimed in the same direction, focused and intense. This weapon proved to have the power of a banana cream pie 3 feet in diameter when dropped from a stepladder 5 feet high. So what he's suggesting is perhaps that there's not a lot that art can do in these scenarios. So, and he may be right, he may be wrong. How would you react to that?
I think that art and music does have an effect, but it's not an immediate effect, right? So,
yeah.
You know, stopping something like the Vietnam War when you have like a giant war machine going and, you know, people in power already, that, you know, definitely would take some time and some doing. But I think that, you know, changing people's minds is not insignificant, you know? It just takes time, I think.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, you would think with the amount of political protest songs and songs of progressive, you know, change and that have been written in America by Americans about American issues, that we'd be much further ahead than we are right now. You would, so oftentimes I wonder if, like, even writing any protest song or song of you know, with political content does any good. You would, I think we're, you know, 50 years behind where we should be as a culture and in a place, but I think maybe it does. I don't know. We'll keep trying. And I think it's also very cathartic. It's cathartic to whatever it is to write about the things that are bothering you, the dark parts of your fears and everything, and to make something beautiful out of what causes you, that keeps you up at night, is the reason I'm a songwriter. It helps me. It heals me. So it's for me, it's a personal thing. I don't know if it has how much of a political effect or cultural effect it has on the country, though.
Well, an apathy isn't an option at all. Whether or not you think it's futile to speak out, presuming futility is just the ultimate empowerer of a dictator, an autocrat,
sure.
Anything. So I think that no matter how many times an artist doesn't have the power to change or hasn't proved to, or maybe we feel like it's futile, that doesn't at all invalidate the impulse. You know, if you don't speak out, even if it's just to be counted,
yeah,
so that you can look back and say, well, I tried. I said something. I spoke my mind. Thousands of us did. We didn't win that one.
Yeah.
But we were on the right side of history.
I think that explains my constant and futile tweets about Trump. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, what do you guys make of the way that Hillary has or has not marshaled popular music and popular culture behind her, especially compared to the way that Obama did, perhaps more aggressively and more effectively?
Well, people fell in love with Obama, you know, and that's rare. We don't always have to fall in love with our candidates. And I think that as an electorate, we often feel like we do need to. We think this is some kind of romance. And I think that can be a dangerously immature impulse to think that every candidate is our... is either a messiah or our boyfriend or girlfriend.
Can I say for the record, I'm a little bit in love with Hillary Clinton, and I'm not ashamed to say it. I think seeing, especially what she's been, what she's gone through. Yes, she has many flaws. I've got so many flaws, and I'm in love with myself, and I give myself a break. So I think she's wonderful, especially the way she's been handling what she's been facing recently, and with direct power, elegance, I've totally got a crush on her, and here's my other point about it. I do understand why some people just have very negative ideas of her, and they can't shake those negative ideas, and whether those negative ideas are fact or fiction, they're there, and that's so much of what is behind Trump's support group is just a hatred for her, an abstract kind of strange hatred, which I've had those hatreds for things, and so I empathize with that. And I have this, I feel like the people, Trump supporters, like most of my family, I come from Cincinnati, half of my family at least, or at least like aunts and uncles and cousins, are very much, I don't know, we don't talk about it. And I talk about some of them, but they are not ignorant in any ways. They're angry and they're afraid. And Trump, in a funny way, I believe that the whole Trump movement and the thing is a crazy giant protest. people in this country are angry about a lot of things. We're all angry about different things, but we're people are poor and scared, and education and healthcare and the safety of their children. That we're seeing things happen in the world. Everybody's a little bit terrified, and everyone's protesting, sometimes in very different ways. But the whole Trump movement, not him himself, but his people, are not bad people. The people that support Trump, I know that. They're my family, and they're great. They're wonderful, loving people, but everyone's under some spell of anger and fear right now, and Trump is using that to try to take over.
Well said. Korn, there's a line in the chorus of your song which really struck me, especially since you wrote it before this election. Holding on to the past won't make it repeat. Time to get up. I think you're in my seat, which is kind of awesome if you take it from the perspective of Hillary Clinton. What do you make of your prophetic achievement there?
I think it's really fitting in a way that, you know, part of what's going on in this battle is this kind of traditional mentality of Trump, and it really, you know, it's really come down to a lot about sexual politics and about the way we think about men and women. And he is, you know, he's incredibly sexist. He's bragged about being a sexual abuser and assaulting women. And, you know, on the other hand, we have this incredible woman, Hillary Clinton, who's worked her whole life, you know, to try and further the cause of women's rights. So, you know, to me, there is this brutal and ugly power struggle going on. And I really think that, you know, in the very last debate, Hillary Clinton really spoke very eloquently about women's rights and about abortion rights and how difficult that struggle is and how, you know, Trump doesn't empathize with women and he doesn't think about their needs. And so, you know, I really think that women do have to stand up and they do need to vote in this election.
And guys, thank you very much for talking about this project. I want to, before we wrap, I want to ask Matt, what's going on with the with the new National album?
We are deep in it, and I don't think it's going to be done and like soon, but it's very different than Elvi. It's really dark, and there aren't any dick references on the new National record. I get all my silly, crazy, cathartic stuff out with Elvi, and I did that, and I had such a blast. But it's letting me go very dark with the new National record, which is a very a place I love to go. So I'm so excited. The record's great, and I don't know when it's gonna be done though.
So as opposed to all those other sparkly pop National albums.
Right, exactly. No, I really, it's like people have always described our music as dark and goes, you know, very melancholy, whatever, somber places. They haven't heard anything yet. this next thing is crazy, and it's about marriage, and it's about marriages falling apart. And I'm happily married, but it's hard. Marriage is hard, and I'm just, my wife and I are writing the lyrics together and about our own struggles, and it's difficult to write. But it's saving my marriage. I'm not saving my marriage. My marriage is healthy, but it's good for everything. And so it's going to be a strange record, and I'm crazy about it. Thanks for asking, though.
Yeah, and very very quickly, Korn, Filthy Friends. When are we going to hear that?
So sometime next year, we're hoping to have the record out. So soon ish.
Awesome. I'm actually super psyched about it. So, guys, Dave, Matt, Korn, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment with more Rolling Stone music now.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
This segment, as you can tell from the music, we're going to be talking about Lil Yachty. Okay. It is not Lil Yachty's 90th birthday, but it is Chuck Berry's 90th birthday. And this is our first live show, by the way, of Rolling Stone Music Now. In the first half, we talked about some anti-Trump songs, and now we're going to talk about Chuck Berry.
That song sounds pretty good still.
Yeah, it does. It sounds okay.
The kid's got a future.
And we have with us Neil Strauss, the great writer for Rolling Stone and many other places of great books and fame in various areas. Neil?
Hey, Brian. Hey, Nathan. Good to talk to you guys.
What's up, Neil?
What's going on?
Neil Strauss, one of the reasons I do this for a living, I must say, always inspired me, so thank you for being here.
Oh, man.
Not the talking on the radio, but the writing part.
But it was actually your appearance on the Marin podcast that made us all want to appear on the radio.
Yeah, Neil was when you went on Howard Stern and made things very difficult for yourself. That was when that was my inspiration.
Man, I almost broke up my relationship on that show. So let's not do that. Here.
That'll be the second episode of Rolling Stone Music Now on Sirius.
Your history on the radio is spotty, but we'll let you back.
Yeah, it's on Sirius.
Exactly. So listen, you spend some time with Chuck Berry, who is, you know, one of the most important rock artists of all time, spectacularly influential. It's so influential that it's almost hard to put his influence in words, but Neil Strauss put Chuck Berry's influence in words.
it's amazing because there's two sides. But first of all, of course, he's, you know, the inventor or one of the inventors or creators of the music we know, obviously, as rock and roll, along with Bo Diddley and Little Richard, and literally, you know, you name it, John Lennon. He was every rock and roller you look up to looks up to Chuck Berry. He's the one, and obviously he had to sit in jail while he saw the entire music he popularized. People make so much money and get so much fame off that. Well, he's cooling his heels in jail over sort of a racist exploitation of a law.
Yeah, I mean, and we heard Johnny B. Goode, which, you know, is the song that started a million bands, spawned a million riffs, you know, prompted untold numbers of people to sit around, you know, making their fingers numb trying to play it. But when you got with Chuck Berry, which was how many years ago?
He was 83, so 7 years ago.
Wow. When you got with him, it seemed like he was in some way, and you encounter this a lot, the people are in denial of their influence and importance. And it seemed to me that was his response to you whenever you tried to push him on that subject.
It was amazing. And that's what I love about, you know, what we do, Brian, is that by meeting these sort of great cultural icons and actually seeing them as human beings and not as caricatures or, you know, people that belong to the culture, you get to see what is the mind and what is the brain and how was this music created. So first of all, I named my book of interviews "Everyone Loves You When You're Dead," partly because of Chuck Berry, because he didn't see himself as the inventor of rock and roll. He really legitimately denied it. He said so many other people did this before him. He wasn't doing anything new. Yet he wasn't just being humble. He meant it. And really what he thought everyone in the world thought of him as was the guy who transported a miner across state lines and got arrested for it. He still felt all these years later that when he walked out, there was sort of a, you know, this shame around that. It's so interesting. And then the other fascinating thing is, I think in the world we think of Chuck Berry as a, you know, a guitarist, then maybe a poet, then a singer, then an entertainer. But for him, entertaining was everything. Like, to him, all he was doing was just giving the people what they wanted. And so this is his version of my interpretation from talking about how he invented rock and roll, which is he'd go and play these segregated venues, these segregated theaters, whites on one side, blacks on the other. And now the whites wanted to hear the R&B.
But yeah.
On the other side, the blacks wanted to hear the hillbilly music. So we had these two different audiences that had two different sides, and how do I please them both? And putting together the R&B and the blues with the country, and you got rock and roll, just trying to make this disparate audience happy.
Who are the influences that Chuck Berry cited as doing rock and roll before them? Because one of them was Frank Sinatra, which confused me, I must admit.
Yeah, exactly. And that shows how, naive or unthinking it was, but, you know, it was Louis Jordan, which makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
Well, the Louis Jordan thing you can hear, for sure.
Right. You know, Joe Turner makes sense. And really, I think for him, you know, but yeah, he would name Frank Sinatra, Tommy Dorsey, but I think it was just the music he loved, but it, I think the real thing was when he saw Muddy Waters, and both seeing Muddy Waters play and Muddy Waters sending him to Chess to drop off some songs is what changed it, what set him on that path.
You know, it's interesting. On some level, he might be right, because if you go back and listen to the charting R&B hits of the 1940s, you can, starting in like 42, 43, you're hearing rock and roll. You know, so on some level, he's correct. But I think, as you point out, the really interesting thing is bringing in the country. That might be the real kickoff there. You know, and so how much did he speak about the country influences?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting. He didn't really go into it. And here's the other thing that's fascinating. I love meeting people and seeing what they're all about. But to him, the song he talked about the most that he wrote, what song do you think that was?
I believe it was My Ding-a-ling, right?
Yeah. Of course it was My Ding-a-ling, because Chuck Berry is a failed comedian. That's his.
Yeah.
That's what he is in his mind. It's like he just wants to make people laugh. And he wants to be funny. And he wants to be a comedian. The whole interview was just, half of it was him trying to crack me up. Well, and the only reason I got like the longest interview probably in Chuck Berry history. And I got it later. I got to tell you how the interview started, because it's like,
yeah, I was going to get there. Yeah.
Well, just
to
throw in, like, My Ding-a-ling was also his biggest hit, right? I mean, he got the most feedback in some way, which is a crazy irony. I mean,
and for those who do not know this song, this is more or less a song about Chuck Berry's penis, right? Basically.
Right.
Yeah. The early 70s, right? Novelty. Yeah.
Yeah. His penis in the early 70s, yes. not his later period of that.
Which is his other obsession. This is the great Chuck Berry book that hasn't been written. He saved photographs of all his experiences and all the stories, and he wants to put it together into a book.
And when you say experiences, you mean experiences.
Yeah. I mean, all his sexual experiences.
Yes.
Nathan was right there, which is, yes, Chuck Berry knows the amount of the check that he got from My Ding-a-ling, which I think was something like $250,000. So yes, it also gave him the biggest check and his only number one.
Well, actually, that sounds to me in a different course, which is, it struck me that Chuck Berry has, in his later years, he's hurt himself in a way that's a little bit sad by turning down the big checks for the little checks. He was so interested in going on the road and getting that cash in advance, and was too suspicious to make the kind of deals that maybe would have really given him a ton of money or sustained his legacy in it, which is a little sad, isn't it?
Well, yes and no, and you totally nailed it, which is that people think of Chuck Berry as this kind of cantankerous, self-sabotaging, impossible to work with guy, but here's the other narrative, and let's keep in mind that, first of all, what you say is true. But he's also, it's not like money is his goal. He's never sold T-shirts at concerts.
Mm.
He's never sold music at concerts. He's never sold any merchandise at concerts, despite his band saying, like, what are you doing? But he has the way he does things. And this explains Chuck Berry, because, again, he has such a reputation as, you know, just cantankerous and tough to deal with, which is, you know, playing music in the time he was playing music, all you do is you get ripped off. And Chuck Berry's a learner. And so every time someone rip him off, not pay him, he'd set a new rule. So by the time you're 90, you've got thousands of rules and they're really hard to work with, and each comes from one specific bad experience.
Is it also about control too? I mean, he wouldn't sell T-shirts because he wants to do it all himself.
Yeah, right? It's probably true. If one person rips him off selling something where he's not there, right? But I guess he could make the choice to go there and sell it himself after the show.
But yeah, let's start at the beginning, which is you show up at this club, and what happened from there?
Yeah, so I'm told, and again, like, I think, and as Nathan knows, who's been my editor at Rolling Stone for so long, when you're doing some of these stories with these sort of unreachable icons, you might work for, it was probably like 6 months to a year working to get a possibility to talk with Chuck. We didn't even know what happened, because he doesn't do interviews, and I was told finally that he would look at me.
Literally, yeah.
Yeah, and it was very likely that, and again, it's the St. Louis, it was very likely that within, at the club Blueberry Hill, it was very likely that within 5 minutes he would walk out. There was a 5% chance. And so you prepare for it, you just go there, and you kind of hope that somehow this is going to work. And have you been in that situation, Brian?
I have. I haven't had as many of this sort of like the Van Morrisons of the world. Hi, Van, if you're out there. Van Morrisons of the world who are, you know, supposedly horrifying and impossible to interview and stuff like that. I've tried to avoid those out of fear. But but yeah, no, I mean, certainly I've had things where it's like you show up and, you know, they might like you, they might not, you know, if, you know, that, like, I've had publicists say, you know, I'm going to check in at 30 minutes and don't be hurt if they're just like, yeah, we're done.
Let's just take a wait and see approach.
So yeah, sorry, go on, Neil.
We really should do an episode about, like, the art of the interview and how you keep a publicist away from an interview. You know?
Yeah, but that's, yeah, yes, we should, but we should make sure somehow that no publicist can hear it. If we can just figure that out. Then, yeah. Love you, publicist. Like,
yeah. Okay. So I walk in, and the first thing he says is he starts giving me shit for being late. And now, however, I'm 2 minutes early. So right away, like, and there's a big lecture about how he worked at Kroger's and you know, and the store opened, you were there, and if you were a minute late, you didn't get paid. And so he's like, what do you mean? You kind of got to just, like, you're not going to argue with him. You just sort of, like, you know, accept it. So you're in his reality. Mm. Next thing he says is, can I see the list of questions? So what would you do in that situation, Brian?
You know, I would claim to have no list, which often is the case, by the way. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I have one. It's in my back pocket, but I never look at it. So I get out of that and say, hey, it's just more about having a conversation.
Mm.
Next thing is he wants to, but so he's really, really reluctant, and he's asking all these questions about how to trust me. And I don't know if you do this, but I always bring two tape recorders because I once interviewed, like, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. It was like their only interview, and like they'd done together in years and years, and the tape recorder went out, so I learned my lesson the hard way.
I do in fact bring two recorders in, and I've now referred to it in so many articles that I have to stop referring, because often the artist will, you know, so because Harrison Ford made fun of me for having two tape recorders, and I told him Bruce Springsteen got three, and then he's like, oh, you know. So I think
Madonna kind of called you out too, right?
Madonna actually made sure that they were arranged properly. It was bugging her that they weren't next to each other perfectly. So anyway,
yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll do that with people. I'll kind of move like a piece of silverware that you're eating something, see if they move it back, and then you know they're OCD level. So yeah, I tell them that he can keep, you know, one of the recorders or one of the tapes afterwards, so we can have a copy. And so again, I thought I was going to last 5 minutes, and then he started making a joke. I laughed at the joke. I added to the joke, basically the joke, and it was kind of interesting because it says about his personality, how he was playing in the casinos and playing slot machines that had four jackpots, and he thought, you know, can I see five? Can I get five jackpots? And you know, I wonder if there's anything bigger, you know, if you can raise a roof off a show or get this, is there anything bigger? I want it all. And so we joked around about that. As soon as I laughed at his jokes, he removes his sunglasses, he looks at me, and he goes, I can feel you're a good interviewer. This is going to last a while, and I'm going to tell you things that I've always wanted to say for years.
And didn't he also at that point actually put in his hearing aid, which he didn't have in?
Yeah, actually listen to me. Yeah. So, and it's those moments. It really is like going to an interview. Really is like you're not their friend. As the press, they're going to pretend to like you, but you're not their friend. But that moment when they feel like they trust you or they can relax with you, which is really not making someone not feel judged, I think.
Yeah.
That moment when it all came together. We covered everything. We covered like Little Richard hitting on him. All these, like, he opened up about, oh man, there's a thing I didn't put in the story.
Yeah.
But he was talking about, like, so this interview at, I want to say it was like five hours, two or three segments, longer than ever interviewed anyone could remember. And by the second interview, I think, I don't know if he forgot it was an interview, but he started talking about how, you know, man, like when men have breasts and they're very kind of flabby in the chest and how attractive that is, how he finds that hot sometimes. Like he just, there was no
okay.
filter anymore.
Yeah. on that note,
that's where rock and roll comes from. It's not just the technique, it's the sex and the drive.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was a super freak before Rick James.
Absolutely. Yeah,
exactly.
On that note, I knew we'd get into Chuck Berry's sex life at some point during the show. Why not in our first live episode? On that, we're going to go to a break and we'll be back with more Rolling Stone music now. Neil, please stick around.
Sure.
Sometimes I will.
You know, the thing about Chuck Berry is I love Chuck Berry. I mean, I really feel like his music hasn't aged. I've played it, little kids still respond to it. There's just something so primal and powerful in it. Does he?
That's amazing. It's just so timeless. Just that boogie woogie piano, like as you're listening to that country rhythm guitar, you know, and it's just short, catchy, and then just his voice just barrels through it. It's just amazing.
He's also got a crazy amount of deep cuts. Like a lot. I mean, that box set that came out, what was it, 15 years ago now, is incredible.
Yeah. Neil, does Chuck care about rock and roll as a thing, or does he see himself also as something much broader? Because it seems like he wants to croon every opportunity he gets. So how do you see that?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. He actually, so, you know, he announced he has a new album coming out.
Yeah.
His first in, I don't know, how many years is it?
Yeah, it's since the 70s, I believe. And as I said, it's the equivalent of Drake dropping a new album in the year 2077.
It's
incredible. So anyway, go on, Neil.
So he played me like 8 new songs, and you're absolutely right. And again, it's so funny because people have a weird, people are so close to themselves that they don't see their own legacy or their relationship with their legacy, and the things they regret are things that people don't think of anymore. So we played these new songs, and most of them were sort of like, a lot of them were spoken word pieces, because he really thinks himself as, I mean, and is a poet, and his original songs came from poems that he had written. So, you know, so a lot of them were kind of crooning songs. You mentioned the Frank Sinatra connection earlier. So a lot of them were croon songs or spoken word, which were actually great songs. One called Temple Woman. I wonder what'll be on there. And then there's the bad move, which everybody always does, because you don't know. No, you can't engineer why your music took off. So he has Lady Be Good, which is a revival of Johnny Be Good, which is just don't do it. And then he also feels. He feels like his song Havana Moon, which wasn't popular because of Castro. He felt it was so stupid to do a song about Havana Moon because, you know, of Castro at the time were people against Cuba. So he's finally decided, half a century later, that if he calls it Jamaica Moon, it will not be popular. Then there's a great song that I really like called Loco Joe, which is kind of like that, you know. Which is more of like a great kind of humorous rocker, and there's one called The Big Boys, which is a bit of a throwback. But I wonder how many will be on the album. But it was a mix of like those three things he does: the crooning, the rocking, and the poetry.
How does Chuck feel about the fact that, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, even the Beach Boys made so much money off, to a certain extent, things he invented?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, the other thing I'll do besides playing just Chuck Berry for people is like play Chuck Berry and then play the Beatles or the Beach Boys or the Stones, and they're the exact same. You know, they're the exact same riff sometimes. But I felt read in other interviews where he was bitter. He didn't seem to have an issue with it. He really was not connected or bitter about that versus, say, Bo Diddley. When I interviewed Bo Diddley, who had these amazing new songs he was working on that never got out, it always upset me. But Bo Diddley was really angry. He felt like, because I couldn't copyright my beat, and that Bo Diddley, you know,
right, yeah,
taken by everybody. He just feels like, I remember he said my mailbox should be swelling like a football with royalty checks. So he was really upset about it. But Chuck Berry were like, so, you know, Chuck Berry said that the way that John Lennon said his biggest influence was me, my biggest influence was Einstein.
Yeah, and of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, they both changed the world as far as I'm concerned. You know.
Right. And like there was some elegance to Einstein taking, you know, reducing the world to these very simple formulas that he was impressed with.
I mean, and Chuck, people have pointed out that, you know, so Bob Dylan obviously won a significant prize for literature recently, and people pointed out, I mean, listen, you know, Chuck Berry, absolutely phenomenal lyricist, a real poet of poet of making his own little teenage symphonies. You know, the lyrics, the specificity, the inventiveness, like one of the greatest lyricists of all time.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's a really good point that it's overlooked, and a lot of people. It was really these were complete. You know, songs, not just ideas or riffs, and it really—I think that influenced so much songwriting. I really think it's over the poetry side and the lyricist side is really overlooked.
And of course, like the Beatles got so much credit for writing their own songs and are credited with separating rock, making rock this original art form. But Chuck Berry was, you know, writing his own stuff a decade before.
Right. He was important to remember. He was the lead singer, he was the lead guitarist, and he was the songwriter. Elvis, as much as I love him, just the singer. You know, Buddy Holly, not as much of a lead guitarist. So, I mean, Chuck was, you had to sort of, you know, people would need 2 to 3 people in their band just to replicate the Chuck Berry experience.
It's
really cool, you know, and I hope he's doing okay. It's really cool that he's still with us. It's almost like he's a pop cultural time traveler, you know, that he's still around in this age of, you know, yeah, Drake and Lil Yachty. And yes, Chuck Berry's releasing a new album.
And I mean, that's what's amazing of the three pioneers of rock and roll, and again, working for Rolling Stone, to actually get to meet them is insane. But I mean, two of them are still with us. We lost Bo Diddley, but Little Richard is just hanging on, and you know, wasn't doing well when I interviewed him, and Chuck Berry is 90 and still, and you can go see him at Blueberry Hill in St. Louis, I think, any time.
And you know, it's everybody loves you when you're dead, and as you named your book, it's important to give some love to these icons, to these people who formed the music and the culture that we still have while they're around. So this is a chance to do that. And Neil, you were nice enough to call in and give us a chance to do that. So thank you.
All right, thanks. Have a good rest of the show, and congrats on the first episode.
Thank you. And you can go read Neil Strauss and a whole lot of other stuff at RollingStone.com. And this was our first live episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. I've been Brian Hyatt, and we had Nathan Brackett.
We did it.
And we did it. And thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for listening.